From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Good to have you along with us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. This week opened fresh off some earth-shaking political headlines from primary day. Not necessarily here in Monroe County or the Finger Lakes, but downstate, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won an upset victory over longtime Democratic incumbent Congressman Joe Crowley.
And yet, not a whole lot of Americans are voting, especially in primaries, even down in that district. Fewer than 1 in 5 registered voters participated in primaries last month. Voting rights activists say there are steps we can take to increase those numbers, including automatic voter registration when people turn 18 years old or become citizens.
In this clip, our guests discuss that prospect and if we're likely to see automatic registration in New York State. You'll hear from Michelle Long, an elections inspector, Simeon Bannister from the Community Foundation, Jesse Lenny of the Working Families Party. But up first is Monroe County Board of Elections Commissioner Tom Ferrazzi.
I think it's a great question. I mean, and universal registration is something that I've talked about numerous times in various presentations around the county. There's a lot of ways that we can move in that direction if, in fact, people aren't comfortable jumping right to that. But I think that that certainly is something that we should be looking at and moving towards that. Interim steps, statewide registration instead of county registration, just the whole kind of different ways of doing registration. But I think universal registration should be an ultimate goal, yes.
I had a question about whether or not that is a thing in any. Are there any states that do it? Do we have any research about whether or not that increases voter turnout?
Well, there's some, not specifically related to voting, but there's some really interesting research that's been done, behavioral economics. I know in Sweden, there was a change for organ donors. And so you would opt out of organ donations, and organ donations went up like dramatically. I mean, like to the tune of like 80% opt-in. Or 80% participation, rather, because of having folks automatically opted in as opposed to opting out. And so it's really, I mean, there's a lot of great research. The, I'm going to mess up and say, is it Richard Thaler, I think it was, but don't quote me on that, is one of our recent Nobel Prize winners who's done some fascinating research on behavioral economics as it relates to opt-in programs. The one thing I will say is, I think it's fair to ask the question, qui bono, right? I think, you know, there's generally universal agreement that everybody should have the opportunity to vote, right? There's generally universal agreement that we want everybody's vote to be counted. I think it's very difficult to find folks that would disagree with that. So then why isn't it happening, right? Who stands to benefit? Who stands to gain when people aren't participating in our process? Who stands to benefit when certain voices seem to be marginalized? Right? Who stands to benefit when folks that have been released from prison who should have their voting rights restored and those rights aren't restored? Who stands to benefit? Who stands to benefit when communities of color in particular are left on the sidelines from being able to participate in our elections? And I think those are the real questions that we've got to start asking if we're going to really get to the bottom of this problem, because in many ways, the legislative process has lent itself to allowing those folks to kind of hide out in some corners and to be obstructionist and block the kinds of reforms that are necessary both in this state, but then also just nationally. And I think that's a really, you know, kind of critical piece of this that we've got to start to explore.
Do you think voting should be compulsory?
I don't know that it should be compulsory. I mean, folks, you know, deserve the right to choose. And in many ways, people make a statement in some instances by not voting. I often hear after elections, you know, folks kind of lament that, you know, how unfortunate it is that people didn't, you know, come out in their interest and vote for the candidates that they should vote for. And I think that sometimes people have made a choice not to participate, right? And so, and people shouldn't be deprived of that opportunity. So I don't know that compulsory is the right route, but I absolutely think that, like I said, folks being informed, folks having education, I think those are the kinds of things that then lead to better candidates, and better candidates drive people to come out and participate.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, what do you think?
I mean, we definitely support universal or automatic registration, also same-day registration. If people walk up to their polling place on election day, they can register on the spot in some places. I think that would help. That would be better. But I think when, you know, and just being involved in campaigns with limited resources, it seems like there's always limited resources. It's hard to imagine candidates spending money on folks who were automatically registered. I mean, we already have it at the DMV where you can register at the DMV. We should expand that to other agencies so that makes it easier. But you know, what we really need is more resources, more candidates, like Simeon said. You know, but obviously knowing where folks live or where they once lived is a help for candidates can reach out to different constituencies to expand the people that they want to talk to for an election. But given limited resources, I think we shouldn't expect a whole lot of turnout based on those improvements.
And to answer Michelle's question, 12 states and the District of Columbia have automatic voter registration. Next, a conversation about the good and the bad news for American atheists. Recent surveys show that almost 1 in 4 Americans now identifies as non-religious. That doesn't necessarily mean atheism, but it means a shift away from overtly religious.
So in that sense, it's more comfortable for atheists in modern society. But when it comes to policymaking, atheists often feel excluded. And in this clip, Carol Hope talks about how difficult it was for her to finally decide to tell her friends that she is an atheist. Carol is an organizer for Secular Humanists of Rochester.
I feel much more comfortable, and I was pretty much in the closet. I've been an atheist my whole life, but I never really used the word, and I credit Linda with giving me the courage to come out of the closet. I saw her on television when the Supreme Court came down with their decision, and she was standing on the steps of the Supreme Court and said, "Atheists need to come out of the closet so it will become more acceptable." And that was when I did that. And many times when I'm with other people and I mention that I'm an atheist, they will sort of whisper to me, "I am too."
Yes, interesting you bring that up. I just, for the first time, watched a movie that I think is 12 years old now. Sean Penn played Harvey Milk. And Harvey Milk, in his activism in the 1970s before he was assassinated in San Francisco, would urge fellow gay people to come out of the closet, not just for themselves, but as a duty to other gay people. And that has been controversial, not just in Harvey Milk's day, but even today. It's hard to tell gay friends who may not feel comfortable, you know, come out for everybody's sake. Well, Harvey Milk did that. And I don't know that it's a perfect parallel, but I think there is, to some degree, when you talk to people who are atheists, they feel like that there is some sort of a stigma that it can be difficult. So what was the difficult thing for you? What were you most fearful of in your years in the closet as an atheist?
Well, the stigma. And I think part of the stigma of atheism arose in the 1950s when atheism was thought of as those godless communists. And I don't know whether it started then, but I think there is a lot of connection there. I want to say, too, about bumper stickers. I have 2 bumper stickers on my car. One says, "I believe in good," and the other says, "Good without a God." And I've suggested this to some of my fellow atheists and humanists, and they're a little afraid to do that. But my tires haven't been slashed yet.
Did your decision to, quote-unquote, come out impact any of the relationships that you feared would be harmed?
Yes.
It did?
Yes. I had a couple of very religious Catholic friends. Now, I consider a person who goes to Mass every day as being very religious. And I first mentioned that I didn't believe in an afterlife, and she really didn't know how to handle that because she knew I was a good person. And she just couldn't believe that a good person would not believe in God. And it was sort of a cognitive dissonance on her part. She really didn't know how to handle it. And it never got to hostility, but the relationship was never as warm as it had been previously.
The new Jurassic Park movie, or Jurassic World movie, is #1 at the box office, and it just goes to show you that even 25 years after the first film was made, people are still fascinated by dinosaurs. And now some scientists are saying that they'll be able to recreate living dinosaurs within the next 5 to 10 years by working with the genes of chickens.
But not all scientists agree. Dr. Larry Buckley is an associate professor at RIT, and he says recreating a dinosaur is virtually impossible. Here he is explaining why.
So it's overstating the possibility to say that we can reverse engineer a chicken into a dinosaur. I think folks have to keep in mind that dinosaurs and chickens had a common ancestor that predated them by 100 million years or more, actually. And so all you're going to get by reverse engineering some genes that cause chicken embryos to grow tooth buds and then lose them later, is a real good insight into how chickens develop. But you're not making a dinosaur by doing that. So it's important to understand that these organisms are 25, 30,000 different genes all interacting simultaneously during the development of the organism. And to recreate those interactions to make what existed in dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs, as we call the big exciting ones, right, is combinatorially, in mathematics terms, virtually impossible, right? You can learn a lot about how a chicken develops from studying the genes that caused the chicken's ancestors' hands to evolve into wings. The bones are still in there, the genes are still in there. But that's not the same as creating a whole different species. That's a very different thing.
So let's talk about some of the ethics here. And let's go ahead and reference, I wasn't a huge fan of the Jurassic Park films when they first came out. I did think that Jeff Goldblum clip is really good. I do. And so I want to listen to it. This is from the original film in which Goldblum plays Dr. Ian Malcolm. And he is, of course, debating whether or really confronting the Alan Grants of the world for what are you doing and why here? Let's listen to that clip.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
It's hardly appropriate to start hurling generalizations.
If I may, I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You know, you read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
All right, first of all, Jeff Goldblum rules. I love that scene. But I think it's really good. I think the question's important. And, you know, so let's tackle this here. Larry, when it comes to whether or not they can, is there anything useful if science does create some sort of a route to recreating a lost species, whether it's a dinosaur, or as Amy, I think, really aptly points out, there's many other more recently extinct species that maybe we wish we could have prevented their extinction. Is this a good idea? Is there a public utility to doing this?
So there is, Evan. I mean, there's a tremendous public utility to using the technology that Jack Horner and others refer to, the CRISPR technology, for exchanging genes from previous organisms into genomes of existing species and seeing what that changes in the existing species, like the chicken example he uses where they recreate or try to recreate a more primitive version of their wing. There's tremendous value in that because of what it teaches us about gene expression and how gene expression affects the development of an organism, and particularly how we can use that knowledge to help affect therapies on disease states, for instance, crop pesticide resistance, drought resistance. It can be used, that technology and that knowledge can be used across the gamut, from not just with vertebrate animals like dinosaurs, but with all living organisms. So it's extremely valuable work. The work is also valuable from a philosophical perspective to try and convince people of the deep, deep age of the planet and respect for that deep, deep age of the planet and the living organisms on it. So from a conservation perspective, it's extremely important work. I don't think it's particularly important, and I don't think the work that I've read is being used to recreate dinosaurs. It's not. I know that makes a great clip, but it isn't really being done for that purpose. The developmental biologists that are doing it for these other reasons, and they're very, very valuable reasons.
Finally, this week we launched our third annual Summer of Food series. Every Thursday at 1 p.m. during the summer, we're talking about food, agriculture, trends, and more.
This week we had a discussion with local chefs about the life and death of Anthony Bourdain. It involved some discussion of what the chefs would like to change about dining culture. In this clip, you'll hear Mark Cupolo, chef and owner of Rocco in Rochester. He's about to drop a bomb on how we eat pasta.
Well, I think if you're at the very high end of the price spectrum, which I've always been, I think it's important to not serve a portion that's too small. That really will reverberate through the community by word of mouth. I've always had portions that I felt were on the large side. I'm a big eater. I always eat everything on my plate. That being said, I think, again, I'm going to keep referring to the old versus the new. You know, the old Rochester, you had to have a humongous portion. You had to be able to take some home with you in order to be happy, I think, you know. And but that's changed over time, too, and the how you put your plate together, too. Maybe the size of the protein has come down, but the rest of it, you know, I just think that we give a big portion, I believe, and we charge a lot of money for it. And if they want to get two meals out of it, that's fine. I know my girl, she does that every time. She eats half of her meal and takes the other half home and eats it for lunch. The pasta comment on the phone caller there, I have to disagree with one of the things he said. And you can get a good dish of pasta in Rochester, New York. There's no question about it. That's a ridiculous statement. The portion, I think pasta in Rochester is all backwards to begin with. And that goes back to the question we talked about earlier about what's Italian food. Well, if anybody's been to Italy, they know that that pasta is a middle course, antipasto, pasta, main course. The pasta portions in Rochester are all too big, because people in Rochester eat pasta as a main course. That's unheard of in Italy. So
I never knew that. That's some noodles,
yeah, it's
right there.
Antipasto. They call the pasta course the primo. Mm-hmm. And then the secondo is the meat or fish. Okay. And that's usually a small and very simple portion for those who want some meat or fish.
Okay.
But the pasta is something that's probably what would be a half portion here. It's eaten before the main course. It's eaten very quickly, too. It's small portion. You eat it quick. You don't let it sit there and congeal while you talk and look at your phone and everything else. Right. You know, it's so pasta right. service in Rochester, I think, in general, is it's not authentic. You right. know,
that's true. The part that's true.
That's okay. It baffles me a little bit. It doesn't baffle me. I know that's the way it is, but it's kind of hard to look at those giant bowls of pasta that we serve or other places serve because it's.
But wait, you're saying you serve giant bowls of pasta, too?
We do because people want them as a main course.
Yeah. So you're participating in the backwards culture.
Well, I'm not gonna pretend. There's no way that you're gonna change the culture here about right. eating pasta
in one restaurant.
In general,
yeah. This is a call to all Rochester restaurants, starting with Mark Cupolo on Connections. Smaller portions of pasta, not the main course.
Right.
Okay.
That being said, too, I think in Italy, I think the antipasto. This is the way I understand it. That is in restaurants for people that have money, that go out, that have enough money to order antipasto, pasta, and secondo. Now, if you don't have enough money, you go to a restaurant that might be called an osteria or something like that. You may have your pasta and your main course, or you may just have your pasta, and that's it, you know, so.
That's interesting.
But in order to really have an authentic Italian meal, you have to have three courses, you know.
And that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Don't you dare order a huge bowl of pasta, Megan Mack.
Whoops.
What is that, your lunch?
What if you enjoy it? Hey, don't judge. This is a judge-free studio.
It's a judgment-free zone on Connections, of course. But interesting. Food for thought.
That is true, though. When I lived in Italy, that was very true, yeah, both with my host family and everywhere we went.
Yep,
so.
He was on the money with that description. Did you like I said food for thought?
Oh, and you hate puns. Time to wrap it up, Evan Dawson.
Yeah, it's Connections every Monday to Friday, weekday afternoons, noon to 2 on AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everybody. He's Evan, I'm Megan. We'll talk to you Monday. Enjoy that pasta.